Well, welcome back to Cocoa Radio, guys. This is the show where we go behind the scenes with macOS 10 developers from around the world. I hope that 2006 brings lots of great Cocoa code to the market from existing developers and folks just putting their toe in the water for the first time. I've heard lots of stories of people getting started with new apps, and it's a really exciting time. As you all know, Apple's market share is on the uptick. There's certainly going to be some exciting things announced at Macworld next week. And in general, it's just a great time to get started. I'd like to publicly proclaim that I intend to finish my beginning macOS 10 programming book. I happen to have had Michael Trent and Drew McCormick's book on my desk for a few months and got kind of stalled out. And I'd really like to make it through it. And I don't know what'll come of it when I'm done, but nonetheless, so that's one of the things I'd like to do this year. So I want to inspire any of you that are new to Cocoa to dip your toe in the water. Listen to a lot of the podcast here and certainly check out all the great examples of code that are out there for the Mac platform. Well, today I'm coming at you from Dallas, Texas again, and that'll be for the next two shows, which include Paul Kafasis of Rogue Amoeba and the Audio Hijack Pro application that they're well known for. And after that, I'll have Alf Watt from iStumbler.net. Those two shows will be posted as soon as possible, and then following that is a show to be re yet to be recorded with Colin Barrett and company from the ADM project, which is an open source project. I would guess a lot of you're using that as a multi protocol IM chat client. If you don't use it, check it out. Get some questions posted to the blog. It's a great app. I finally started using it again after quite a hiatus, but I really am enjoying the newest release. I'd also like to talk quickly about Cocoa Radio itself. For 06, this was an experiment starting out to something I wanted to do to get to know developers in OS 10, and it's worked out well. I've met some great folks and brought some great stories to a much broader audience. It's turned out to be several thousand people worldwide, and that's pretty much a surprise. But nonetheless, I want to grow it because this is much more than me. I want to open it up to anyone who's interested in contributing to this project, open it up to advisors, reviewers, designers, and di people with different expertise. I've mentioned several times about moving from TypePad to something I can have some more control over, and I've got some recent volunteers for that, but certainly room for others. So drop me a line if you have interest in various aspects of Cocoa Radio or ideas. Ping me on IM or Skype, and we can chat about it. The la another thing I'd like to add to it is some kind of intro. I know lots of podcasts have some really polished intros. I just want something on there that kind of like a trademark of sorts. One that really gets my attention is Kevin Rose and Dignation. They do a great job there on the front end. And then I also study a bit of Mandarin, and Chinese Pod has something a pretty cool mashup of clips from shows and whatnot. So check those out, or if you got some favorites and some musical talent, drop me your ideas or just get in touch and we can chat about that some more. I want to reiterate that I am planning to be at Macworld. I got my ticket, my pass, not a press pass, but supporter pass they're calling it. Nonetheless, I'm sure it'll be a lot of fun, and I'm very excited to be out there. I've talked to a number of you about getting some interviews on the floor, but anyone I've not heard from, please drop me a line. And let me know you're going to be there, and we'll see what we can at least exchange mobile numbers so we can catch up during the show. I will also be attending the Mac Small Business Dinner, which is Wednesday night at 7 p.m. San Francisco, and that was organized or is organized by Niall Kennedy of Technorati. Check out his blog or the show notes here for a link to that if you don't know about it already. But it's going to be at a little Chet cafe, a little Indian cafe, and I think last time around there was probably 50 people showed up, and so be sure and check that out. Come if you're going to be in town, and it should be a lot of fun. Lastly, I'd like to mention donations. I've never publicly solicited donations, nor for a number of reasons, but I've received some, so I wanted to say thanks to folks that have sent things in, and really surprised. There's certainly things I need to make the show better, and it all unfortunately costs money. I bought a Blue Mic recently, I mentioned on the last show, but I'm planning to add a mixer. I need to buy a Soundtrack Pro, And I'm looking for a new host, text drive, maybe Media Temple, something like that. So, but if you happen to have some server space or software you'd like to donate or straight cash, certainly works. Shoot that to cocoradio@mac.com, and we can talk about where we need most help at this point. And lastly, before we jump into the show, I'd like to mention that I've always intended this to be a creative this show to be released under Creative Commons Attribution License. But for some reason, there's a snag with archive.org when I upload the audio, and it assigns a strict copyright to it. But just to spell it out here, this show is released under Creative Commons Attribution License. We'll fix that on the new content management platform, and you're free to mash it up with attribution. And now, what you've all been waiting for, or many, many of you have asked, is for me to interview Will Shipley, co-founder of Omni Software in Seattle, and more recently founder of Delicious Monster. That's the software company with no office. They develop their apps at Zoka Cafe in Seattle. It's Will Shipley, Drew Hamlin, and a few other folks there. I'm sure you've all seen Delicious Library, but if you haven't, snag a copy. There's links to his student presentation, which from WWDC, which got about 60 some odd thousand downloads. So be sure and check that out, and look for a copy of Delicious Library if you don't already have it, while you kick back for the interview. Before we get started, I got a quick message from our sponsor, Slide.com. Slide is a new free group photo sharing service. Slide makes it easy for all members of a group to combine their photos into streaming slideshows on the desktop or web pages. And best of all for you, Slide is looking for the best Cocoa and web developers. If you're interested, please drop them an email at coco@slide.com. That's coco@slide.com. And now I bring you Will Shipley from Delicious Monster. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Just trying to wrap a few shows before Christmas and get them out there before Macworld. I think we'll have too much competition for news after that hits.
Yeah. It's always tricky to know what to do around Macworld because everybody wants attention right then.
And you guys are going to be there. I saw on your site here, booth
Yeah, I
number
think we're
710.
booth 710, I think 712. I'm not even sure, but it's right near the giant bus of music, the Beatles bus, the John Lennon bus.
Are you going to be participating in some of the panels and sessions also?
No, he didn't invite me. I don't know. I
didn't
guess
invite you.
I'm a little too hot for TV. I don't know.
Didn't you promise to wear the fancy Italian shoes and the fancy shirt?
I would have if they'd called me, but
goodness.
No one called.
Maybe they're
I'm
saving your appearance
it.
For an award or something. Who knows?
Well, I do have to run the booth, so maybe they should and maybe
Well, give us a quick background on Omni. I understand you founded Omni. You were there for like a dozen years or something, and now you've started this other slick consumer-oriented company. It seems like a second coming for you.
Yeah, no, it's been really great to have sort of two successful companies. Most you feel blessed if you have one company becomes success. But to found two, I feel, sort of really, really blessed. And it's nice because, Omni is continuing to do well, without me. They just released, Graffle 4 and Outliner 3, I think. And both are just, seem like really cool products to me. So I'm very excited for them.
The Omni 3 is a great product. I understand, your former partner, Mike, didn't particularly care for the icons though. Created quite a stir out there.
yeah. He made a post where he was like, "Here's what I think should be the new app icon for Outliner." But to be fair, the entire community does this for Adobe and Microsoft and basically every company in the world.
Yeah.
With any notable software, they post, "Here's the icons that I think they should have used." So it's not like Omni got singled out in that one.
Quitting,
I was like, hey, if you're gonna be spending some time redoing icons, you should redo our icon.
There you go. And now you don't even have much, I guess, oversight over him now that he's at Apple, right?
Yeah, now that he's at Apple, I don't get as many icons from him.
You can't threaten him or anything.
he's not legally allowed to be sending icons out anymore.
Yeah. they own everything.
Yeah, everything he thinks.
So Delicious Library is your first app out of Delicious Monster, and that's been out for, about a year now, is it?
Yeah, just a little over a year. We released it November 8th, 2004. And yeah, it's been a tremendous success. Most successful app ever for me. I'm just blown away by the response. I couldn't be more tickled with it.
And you've sold a few copies, a few thousand maybe?
Yes. Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands.
Yeah, I'm not getting exact figures because, you know,
Not yeah.
competitive, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, a lot. And it's been really wonderful.
I'd have to say just kudos on that. You've inspired a whole legion of new Cocoa developers, I think young and old, young and older, let's say. To hear your story, you got the little press there on the Seattle News. That was pretty cool. But just to see that someone, I guess you had some quite a few younger guys working with you too, but working in a cafe, putting out an app of this caliber, and doing new things like the EyeSight barcode recognition is pretty impressive.
Well, yeah, thanks. I mean, it's definitely, you know, part of my mission statement is to just try to inspire people to do their best, you know, and try to lead them towards success, and away from failure, as it were. And that's, you know, that's sort of the thought behind the blog and, you know, a lot of the other sort of public stuff I do. It's not so much to show off as just a chance to say, look, you know, here's how I found some success, and you know, I really want to share this with the world. And, you know, like those guys who get on TV, you know, say, make $1 million of real estate, except, you know, I don't actually charge people to read my blog or whatever. It's just,
So the advice
I'm just,
about becoming a pyrotechnic is free. Is that right?
yeah, that's free bad advice.
Free bad advice. So start fires, write Objective C, and make sure you focus on the UI. Is that
Yeah.
the three top tips?
Yeah, well, people actually took the start fire things as a metaphor, which I thought was funny because it wasn't a metaphor. I was trying to be silly and make a joke, and people were like, they thought, you know, when I said you should quit school and start fires, that I was saying, you know, set the world on fire. And I was like, no, I was trying to make a joke about you should actually just light fires, you know, around your neighborhood. But
Like the
it was
reincarnation
supposed
of Guy
to be a joke,
Kawasaki or something, huh?
something like that.
There you go. Well, we'll dive into. I know you got to start at Next there. Do you want to just give a quick introduction to Next Step and Coco? Because it's kind of a, I guess, manifest. What we've seen today is a manifestation of everything that started, well over a dozen years ago.
Yeah, I mean, back in '89 when I was in college, and dinosaurs ruled the earth, there was, you know, Next was just coming out with their new machine, and Steve Jobs had left Apple and come out with this great 3M machine, they called it, because it was supposed to be, the monitor was a megapixel, it was going to come with a megabyte of RAM, and the processor was going to be 1 megahertz, and that was supposed to be this huge revolution. All three of those were, you know, supposed to be these huge goals, you know, better than any machine at the time, the 3M machine. And it's funny because, you know, nowadays it's like 1 megahertz processor. Wow.
Terabyte of storage,
But yeah, so they came out with the machine, which was, you know, pretty cool. But what was really cool was the software that came with it. The programming system called Next Step, which eventually became the you know, Apple when they bought Next in '97, turned it into Coco. But I started using it back in 1989 in college. Our college bought a couple machines and I started playing with them, and I got in contact with the local Next sales office, and there was a project that they were assisting on, database project for a company called William Morris Talent Agency. And you know, they said, do you want to work on this for us? And I said, sure. And so I just started doing consulting for Next, you know, just in databases, and had an absolute ball, and invited my college friends Tim and Ken to come join me and work on that. And that was the genesis of Omni, and we actually incorporated in '93, and then, you know, of course in '97 Apple bought Next, and we were suddenly Mac programmers. And
Thankfully, without the Mac toolbox, though.
yeah, no, that we've always been on the Cocoa side of things. So
So your
it was
introduction
interesting
is,
because for a while they were talking about having, you know, a lot of people thought Carbon was going to win and Cocoa was going to sort of be, you know, slowly moved out because they're like, you know, there's so many more Carbon programmers than Cocoa programmers. But everybody inside Apple realized how wonderful Cocoa was and decided to play it up. And
That would have happened over Tavanian's dead body, right?
yeah, well, it, at that point, I don't think Avi had as much power, if I recall correctly. But now, actually, I guess Avi's now no longer, he's no longer the VP of software. He's moved sideways, and he's doing something else at Apple, and now it's Bertrand Scalet is VP of software. But, you know, again, he's also an old ex-Next guy and an old friend of mine. And
well, Steve hadn't quite moved everybody out of the way yet, the old IBM.
Yeah, no,
was there, he was in process of moving his guys into position.
Well, it was funny as heck, because when, you know, about a year after they bought, Apple bought Next, you know, if you looked at the vice presidents at Apple, they were, it was like 6 out of 7 of them were from Next. And it was really eerie. I was like, wow, you know, he's just totally moved in his people now. I think the only one that didn't go was like a sales guy was from Apple, but everyone else was ex-Nexters. And the first of them actually is finally retiring. It's, that I know of, John Rubenstein.
Yeah, Rubenstein's going.
Yeah, the original, the guy who, as I recall, and I may be screwing things up, he designed the original Nextbox. And I've always admired his stuff, so.
Very cool.
He's been running the iPod group, I guess, for a while now. And he's finally.
Leave it on a high note for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Relate to people. So it's sort of centered around the code rather than centered around the user.
Well, it seems Apple always finds great new talent to hire in Cupertino. I guess speaking of, what do you make of Mike joining Apple recently there and leaving Delicious?
Yeah, Mike got hired just a couple months ago by Apple to work. And he's like, you know, he's one of 9 UI designers at Apple, so that's you know, quite an honor. You know, he gets to work on editing. You know, he got to work on the photo booth stuff and, you know, all those apps. So,
what are your plans now, Will? It's just you now coding, right? I mean, are you planning to add others, and how big do you plan to grow Delicious?
I don't know. I mean, we had a developer for a while, Tim Omernick, who is now actually a developer at Apple as well. But now it's just me developing, and then I've got I have a bunch of great people who are just helping me out with things like support mail and, you know, keeping the website and stuff like that, which I think is, you know, wonderful stuff to essentially outsource. But I don't know. I like programming by myself. You know, I find it kind of liberating. So I'm not sure how big I want this company to get. You know, I'm not opposed to the idea of hiring people, but I'm certainly pretty happy with the way it is, and I'm certainly really happy with the way the software is progressing right now. So I don't feel any burning needs. You know.
Well, everyone knows how successful Delicious Library has been. I'm sure you got some great features coming in the next revs, and certainly 2.0. But we don't want to see you rest on your laurels. And we know that working solo sometimes can be a bit difficult in terms of motivation. You know, what are your plans? What can we expect next from Delicious?
Yeah, the next thing you're going to see from us is going to be Delicious Library 2.0, which is the one that we've actually announced. And it's we're going to bunch of really cool features for that. And it's a big, big, big release. And honestly, if I had to do it again, I would have broken up into 2 releases and had to be a, you know, 2.0 and a 3.0 with all this stuff in it. But since I've already sort of promised that you know, some of the stuff that I'm going to do for 2.0, I'm just going to go ahead and grit down and do it all in one release. And so it'll do a couple months, but it should be well worth it. 2.0 is actually the app that Mike and I had originally envisioned 1.0 is going to be, but then we realized, you know, that's just too much to do in one release. But 2.0 is the reason we did it. You know, when we initially sat down, we said, this would be a really cool app. It was the 2.0 that we were talking about, and you know, we're really happy that people love the 1.0, and I think it's a great app. But the 2.0 is what we always envisioned was the thing that people are going to go, oh my gosh, that's really, really cool. But I mean, you know, it's sort of, you know, as you go and you develop apps, you hope that you find lots of cool things along the way. Anyway, like the eyesight scanning was one of those things that I just thought up one night, and I had no idea if we could do it or not. I had no idea if it was even technically possible. No one had done it before. And people just love it. People just think it's the coolest thing ever. And so it was one of those, you know, really just serendipitous things where it wasn't supposed to be one of the highlights of the app. It was just something I thought up and said, oh, and in addition, you know, if you happen to have an eyesight, you can do this. And it turned out people just love it, and it's selling iSights and selling Macintoshes. And
Well, I know as soon as I saw it, I had to buy it. I had heard all the murmur on the web, the blogosphere about it, so I jumped on it, bought a copy, and immediately started scanning and collecting all my books around the house, DVDs, etc. My wife got quite a kick out of it. But one thing I noticed was the little Amazon sell on Amazon button. I clicked it, listed several books that had been in the junk pile to go to donations or the trash. And lo and behold, I got like four or five orders over the next, I think, 10 days or so, and made like $30 on Amazon. So I was pretty impressed with that alone. It was kind of paid for this the license fee.
yeah, no, I've had a couple people say that, that they use that part. And then some people, they don't think they're going to use it, and then they discover the loaning feature that you can just, remember who you loan things to, and they're just like, oh my God, that's the best thing ever. I'm always losing my books. Oh my gosh, this would be so great for my DVDs. And so it's one of those where people kind of initially think, oh, it's a cute little toy. And then they start thinking about it and they go, oh wait, this is really great. A bunch of people keep telling us, wow, you could use this for insurance, so that if you get robbed and your house gets robbed, you actually can replace all your stuff instead of just wondering, like, now what did I have and how much was it worth? And that's just huge for people.
Well, certainly the iSight integration was a really big draw for folks, and certainly a cool thing to do on the Mac. What kind of challenge did that present as you got into coding?
It was a huge challenge. I'd never messed with QuickTime at all, because that's all Carbon stuff, the older APIs from Apple. And so, I had to learn how to program to the old Mac toolbox for the first time in my life. And that was just horrible. I mean, that's just, it's so bad, Mac users, we act like snobs against Windows users, but seriously, the Mac toolbox is just, it's horrible to program raw. And it's, luckily it's almost completely phased out. Even the last thing that you had to use Toolbox for was QuickTime, and now in Tiger they've got the new QuickTime kit, and you can actually program QuickTime in Cocoa and Objective-C directly, and it's beautiful. Everyone's gotten religion; they all just realized this is a much easier way to do things. But there's a lot of functionality there in QuickTime, and so I dove in and figured out how to just do the frame capture stuff, which was technically not hard, but required, weeks and weeks of research, because there is no really good example code that actually, is sort of up to date on that. And then I had to figure out how to set the focus on the camera to be really close. You can hold the barcode up and it would be, in focus, because the autofocus wasn't working fast enough. Every time you hold the book up, you have to sit there and wave it around until it autofocus. So I actually have it now, so it does fixed focus. And then I had to actually decode the darn barcode, and that took a month just to figure out how to look at a frame buffer and say, all right, is there a barcode in here? And if there is, what does it represent? And I understand that since I've done it, there's, I think, one or two people who've tried to do it as well. I don't know how. I haven't seen anyone succeeded. People occasionally tell me they've tried some of the others, and they just kind of don't really work yet, but I assume someone will get it someday. But it was really fun to invent that and just realize, no one else has done a real-time video barcode scanner up to that point. No one had tried it, and I was like, this is the first.
So you have the iSight integration in there. Is that you mentioned a problem with the new iMacs, though? Maybe not doing the autofocus. Did you fix your app, or did you figure out how to do it on the new iMacs?
The new iMacs don't have a focus. They actually have a fixed focus, so they focus at about a foot and a half from the screen. So if you hold a barcode just right up to them, the barcode's out of focus and it's all fuzzy, and my old algorithm doesn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I've actually had to take a month out of the 2.0 development cycle, starting back in November, and just totally rewrite my barcode recognition software. And I'm right in the middle of that, and it's actually pretty amazingly cool. But I don't. I'm pretty sure it's going to succeed now where I am, but I haven't finished it yet. I'm actually working on that right now today.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping to announce something by Macworld, but honestly, I don't even know if it's technically possible. It's just one of those things where you take an out of focus barcode and you try to read it, and it could be that, the computer's up to the task of reading out folks' barcodes, and it could be that it's just too much information lost with the focus. So it's really fun and real research. But including it, I mean, it's a totally new algorithm. It has nothing to do with the previous algorithm. So it's, I'm just starting over from scratch and saying, you know, what can I do without a focus? But it looks promising. It looks like it's going to be actually really neat. Because I think it's going to make it so that for all cameras, it's going to be much, much faster and much easier to recognize. So it'll just be, even if you have an original eyesight, you'll just be able to sort of wave the book in front of them and then suddenly go boop and get it. And that's really neat when you do that. And you know, you can imagine there's other uses for this. I haven't, you know, followed up on it yet, but, you know, like you go to the Apple store and they're still using the $800 symbol scanners, you know, with laser and USB exactly. connection. I'm like, hey, you know, you guys have iMac G5s right there. Why don't you just use my stuff and get rid of the scanner? And so, you know, there's obviously a lot more uses for reading barcodes than just books. But yeah, right now I'm trying to stay focused, get this done, get 2.0 out, and then we'll look at the future.
So we're looking at an incremental release possibly by Macworld and then 2.0 maybe another few months out?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a 1.6 in the pipeline that we've announced okay. because we know that Intel machines are coming at some point. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've promised our customers that we're going to have a free release that supports Intel. So we're not going to mm-hmm. force them to pay for the Intel side grade, as it were.
Sure.
And we've got a couple of languages that, you know, people have added localizations for a couple more languages. So if this new experiment works, then I'll also have the iMac G5 barcode scanning in there with the built-in non-focusing thing. So yeah, we've got that incremental release, and then we have the 2.0 release coming a couple months after that, which will knock people's socks off. And then who knows?
Who knows? So a different category? Are we still looking at something ultra-consumer like Delicious Library, or...?
I think we're going to see something in the consumer space. I mean, I'm still honestly just playing around with different ideas. I've got a list. But the one I like best right now is very much in the consumer space. And it's one of these things where you could... I think there's a lot of apps in the pro space that do this, but there's nothing decent in the consumer space. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of these things where you'll see, you know, there's probably 10 programs on Windows that try to do this kind of thing, but none do a good job, so nobody uses them. And that's sort of how we felt about, you know, the Delicious Library was, you know, yeah, you can find apps out there to catalog books, but there's none that I would actually recommend to my mom, and that's, you know, that's how I know that something's wide open to be done is when you see that category of apps, where there's a bunch of them, and yet none of them are very good.
Well, it seems like people have long commented, or probably since you first released Library, that they'd love to be able to share this information on the web with other friends, family, et cetera. And that's kind of the first question you had posted from Matt Buchanan was, he wanted a feature to export his library to the web. Can you comment on that?
Is that? Yeah, we've definitely heard that, and that's you know, I'll answer the question, and then I'll be a little bit weasley about it. That is definitely planned for 2.0. I obviously can't promise any particular feature for 2.0 because it's in the future, but the focus of 2.0 is supposed to be on sharing your collection, and we think that's incredibly powerful. And I want them both share on the web and also make it, you know, go even beyond that. But definitely on the basic, just getting a page up and having your stuff on it and having that built in.
Oh yeah.
I mean, there's apps, there's little, you know, apps that do it right now that you can add on for free, but it should be built in and that's, you know, we're working on that for 2.0. So hopefully that'll be in there. It's certainly what we're trying to do.
Yeah, several developers I've talked to on this show have indicated the opportunity between the web apps, be it Flickr or what other sort of Web2 app, and the Mac desktop. Having been involved with Apple for so long and Next, what do you think about you know, what WebObjects offered at one time, or I guess still offers today, and new frameworks like Ruby on Rails? Is that something you look at when you're looking at creating these web additions to products?
Yeah, I mean, WebObjects was a neat technology, but when they rewrote it in Java, I was just done because I found the performance to be really bad. And I don't program Java. I mean, it's not a language that I particularly learned. And then when I messed around with it, I just didn't like it. I don't like the, you know, framework, but it's just, there's a lot I don't like about it. And I honestly kind of, you know, I don't, all the guys that I knew that were on the WebObjects team that were like my friends and you know, that had done this amazing work back in the old days, the Objective C days, they all just left. And so I don't even, you know, I don't know the engineers anymore. I don't know the technology. So I'm totally out of the web, obviously. Whereas, you know, it used to be that, like, the technology behind that, we used to be sort of the premier developer on it. And in fact, you know, we submitted a ton of code that got into what was known as Enterprise Objects 2.0, which was, you know, the basis of Web Objects. When we were working with Mikasa, you know, way back when, we just sort of gave Apple all our frameworks and said, here, we've written all this. And they're like, cool. And, so it was a really cool technology. But the interesting thing about it for me is that in Tiger, a bunch of that technology came back, a bunch of Objective-C technology came back, but it's now built into the app kit where it should have been from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a separate product. It doesn't cost money. And it's available to all developers in all programs, and that's incredible. That's just amazing. It's amazing. This is what's known now as the core data framework, and it's just the most powerful thing in Tiger. It's you know, it gives you the ability essentially to write every application as a database application, which means you can deal with incredibly huge files without having to think about things like you know, load time and save time and stuff like that. It's essentially free. So it's an amazing technology. That kind of thing really impresses me. And, you know, and the idea of sort of hitting databases remotely is, you know, one of the things that Core Data is good at. But in terms of, I don't know, in terms of just getting at the web, I'm not a Ruby on Rails kind of guy, because again, it's a whole other set of frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, something I would mess with directly. I find it very, very easy to write web apps right now because, you know, most, you know, web services are going to be, you know, XML or HTML. And, you know, people talk about all these frameworks on other platforms, like, does this and this and this. I'm like, yeah, but, you know, on Coco, well, all I do is I say, you know, NSXML document Alec init from URL, and I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have it. I'm not like, you know, yeah, I have this entire framework. I'm like, well, I don't need a framework. It's only one line of code. So it's pretty much done. And that's, you know, that's kind of like about Coco. A lot of people, I've seen a lot of frameworks where they advertise being really big and broad, and I'm like, well, Coco is just, it's very small, but it does just an absolute ton in its smallness, and so it's, you know, it can be apprehended by a single person, which I like.
So obviously, Core Data wasn't out when you first worked on libraries. So is that part of your rewrite also, or update?
Yes, it is. Okay. It's the first time I'm publicly admitting it, but yes.
Because you did write library. you guys did do a nice little story about how Coco bindings changed your original coding of version 1. I think that was
that was sort of the precursor to Core Data, was the binding stuff, mm-hmm. which also came out of Enterprise Objects, but is better on nowadays. But then Core Data came up, and so I rewrote the app on Core Data, and it's just stunning. It's really amazing. I'm not done yet, because I had to stop in the middle to do this camera stuff because the IMAX G5 came out suddenly, and I'm like, oh my gosh. But the early results just blew me away. So I'm very excited about it. And Core Data does some amazing things for you. They tested it, you know, with millions of rows, millions of, you know, objects. And it's, you know, it still just performs great. You know, and if you can imagine, you know, like, imagine, you know, running OmniGraffle and having a million, you know, little, you know, squares or boxes or whatever, you know, and saving that. I mean, it would take you, you know, 40 minutes and the machine would crash right now. But with Core Data, it's just, it's possible. And so, you know, and it's possible for Kinson Graphs. There's no reason not to rewrite OmniGraffle to use Core Data, for example.
So once developers start really taking this by the horns, it seems like we're really going to see some powerful applications and updates to existing apps.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's going to be absolutely stunning. And one of the most, you know, amazing things about it is that it links to built-in database right now, you know, the tiny, SQLite.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason that it couldn't be expanded to link with other databases. Now, I don't have any inside knowledge on this, but, mm-hmm. you know, if it works with C SQLite, there's really no reason that you couldn't say hit an Oracle database that's, you know, on a giant server somewhere. And so suddenly you have this really neat, you know, concept that you can have these like consumer apps that use sort of a database store. But then, you know, if your business grows and it becomes sort of a huge thing, you could actually just move your files over to some giant like Oracle server thing.
Yeah.
And use the same consumer apps and just hit the Oracle server with your consumer apps. And that's just incredibly powerful. That's a really neat idea to me.
Built-in scaling, huh?
Yeah.
Let's go to some of these questions here. You got quite a few that accumulated over time. I have someone here asking about Spotlight's implementation. Talks about, you know, while Delicious Libraries received lots of praise for its UI design, how did you react to Apple's UI choice to place the Spotlight search in the upper right-hand corner of the window? Did the Spotlight UI in Tiger make you cringe, considering the UI and library to match? Or has it had no effect on your design ideas for the future?
There's some definite problems with the UI of Spotlight, the way it's implemented right now, but I don't think it's inherent to Spotlight. I think it's just that Spotlight was kind of like the UI came together right before the release.
Mm-hmm. So there's lots more in store.
So I don't know. I mean, like there's a bunch of stuff that's just missing from their UI, for example, that you can do in Spotlight that you just can't. It can't do in their UI, because the way they present Spotlight's UI is it's just like, oh, type in some words and we'll find those words.
Mm-hmm.
But Spotlight's actually way more powerful than that. And if you dig into the Finder now, you can do the thing, and it finally, you know, works in 10.4.3. You can do the thing where you can say, you know, find me files where kind is this, and you know, this keyword is this, and this metadata is this, and actually do metadata searches, which is what Spotlight is really supposed to do, not just free text but searches.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't get that from like the Spotlight panel in the upper right of the entire display. So that's, you know, it's kind of demanding and limiting, because there's lots of times that you do want to, you know, when you're up there, say, find me a mail message, you know, where the from is so and so, but you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, you have to just type some words and hope like heck you get the mail message, and I think that's pretty broken.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would find myself limited to Spotlight's UI for adding really advanced searching to Library 2. And in Library 1, we have a, you know, you can type, and as you type, it does a refinement search. You know, it shows you the items you have that have any sort of matching fields. And we definitely have ideas for searching way beyond that, you know, especially as you introduce core data and you have potential of a lot more items, but I don't think, you know, I don't think Spotlight has necessarily nailed the metaphor, so I'm definitely not going to feel constrained to use their metaphor for searching.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully they have some more ideas in store there. Well, how much time would you say you spend on coding and design versus support for library?
I don't spend any time on support.
I mean
support's incredibly, incredibly valuable. It's way too valuable to have an engineer do it. That's just a disservice to your clients. I have right now is two college kids. In the past I've had, you know, professional, like full-time professionals, but
yeah.
You know, I hire based on, you know, if somebody says I love your product and I know everything about it and I'd love to you know, help out, I say, well, do you want to do some support? And so, you know, we have a kid who's like in Illinois and one that's here at the University of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, support's one of these things where it should be really easy for people going into software business to solve it, because there is, you know, what I consider to be a one true solution, which is, you know, you offer email support, you don't do phone support because that takes way too long and it's simply inefficient for everybody involved. It's inefficient for customers and you. If you have email support, then nobody has to be on site. And you don't need an office, and you don't need hours. You just find somebody who loves your app, knows a lot about computers, and you know, has a laptop, and you're done.
Mm-hmm.
They can be anywhere in the world, and you know, and it's a great you know, way to build up experience and learn things for the support engineers. So,
so Drew Hamlin is there in the Seattle area, right?
Yeah, Drew is here, and actually Lucas Newman is our latest support guy, and he's actually. He's actually just moving up here because he actually wants to take a larger role in the company as well.
This is Chicago
guy. Great, because he's a Yeah, I'm not actually sure where he's from, honestly.
Okay.
I make up a different state every time because I totally don't know. That's the thing. I honestly don't know what state he's in.
He's coming from Rio.
Yeah, sure, why not? But yeah, no, he's been great. He's actually been submitting code to the 1.6 branch while I've been busy working on the 2.0 branch. So he's fixing little niggly bugs for people. And being a Splunk engineer, he knows exactly which niggly bugs are really bugging people, So, if like there's a comma out of place somewhere, I mean, he fixes bigger bugs than that. But, as a really easy example, if there's a comma out of place somewhere, it's really great to have somebody who just goes, "Oh, this is really annoying people. I'll just go in there and fix it,"
Sure. You have a lot of questions here and kind of threads on discussion from actually a blog post by John over at Ars Technica, talking about Objective C and lack of memory management, etc. Where do you stand on that?
Lack of memory management is such a loaded term. The thing about Java is it's really easy to write, demo programs quickly in Java. And I'm not going to make any friends with my stance on Java. I know it. People who like Java love it. I just don't happen to like it. And if it works for you, great. I don't. I'm not fighting to eradicate it from the face of the earth. If you want to use it, that's great. I also, don't like to eat fish guts, but if you like fish guts, fine. Go ahead and eat them. But saying that it doesn't have memory management is just it's kind of crazy because it's like we do have memory management, and actually, I think we have really great memory management. What we don't have is this notion of automatic memory management, but Java's memory management fails. And every time somebody tries to come up with some magic, the computer has just solved this way of doing it, there are some really huge fundamental problems when you're deploying actual commercial apps. But yeah, it looks great in the demo. It looks great in the demo when you've got a Java program and you say, "Look, I didn't have to write any memory management because garbage collection just found all the objects." But if I had my program, the Delicious Library, written in Java, the problem would be that I allocate and deallocate a ton of memory. And in the real world, when you're writing apps that are just pushing the boundaries of the computer, you absolutely need to be able to control when you allocate and when you deallocate. Now, Coco has some things to make it easier so you don't have to worry so much. There's auto release pools and stuff like that. And if you use them correctly, you can essentially treat your app as if it has garbage collection because you create an object and you say, "Hey, at the end of this cycle, you can let go of this object." And, it's one extra word in your, every time you create an object, it's an extra word. And if that really bothers you, then, you probably got some compulsive problems. But you can use that. But the thing is, you can also drop down and not use that and say, "No, I'm going to handle these objects myself. I'm going to figure out when I'm going to allocate them, when I'm going to deallocate them." And there's different brains in between that. There's, "Oh, I'm going to use an auto release mechanism, but I'm going to make sure that I create my own what's known as an auto release pool." And you can have an inner auto release pool so that, if I'm doing like, for example, if I load 1,000 books out of somebody's file, obviously loading a file, you create lots of little temporary objects during a load operation. And that can, get very expensive. And if you create them all at once and you never free any of them, what happens is your machine runs out of RAM, so it starts, allocating virtual memory, which is incredibly expensive, in terms of time. And it's completely unnecessary because those objects were just temporary objects. But, in Java, you don't have a good way of saying, "Look, that was a temporary object. I only needed it for, a tenth of a second. Now I'm done with it, and I'd really like to reuse that RAM." You don't have a way of doing that. You're at the whim of the machine to say, "Oh, I hope there's a garbage collection soon." Whereas, in Coco, you can actually just say, "Oh, every 100 objects I load, every 100, books or whatever from this file, go ahead and clear out all the temporary objects." And that's 2 lines of code to do that. And it, it makes running so much faster, and it makes it work so much better. So for me, I like to have the control. I need it. I like it. There is a learning curve associated with Objective-C's memory management because it's not, magic the way Java is. But on the other hand, it lets you actually control your actual allocation of resources. And, when I look at the apps that I admire most, they're not written in garbage collected languages. They're just not.
So you think it's just a learning curve there for folks coming out of school that have been taught the Java way, and now they're kind of wondering why Objective-C doesn't offer these
Well,
things.
yeah, I mean, it's maddening for them because they're like, well, this is really not nearly as friendly, and it's true, it's not as friendly, but it's like graduating from art school and discovering there's a lot more colors of paint than red, green, and blue, and going, well, life was easier when I just had red, green, and blue. It's like, yeah, but it's we're gonna paint using the full palette now. And
We got another question here from down under, Mark Northrup, who actually does some of the AAC enhancements for Coco Radio. He was curious about your take on Sparkle, Avalon, and future API directions at Apple. You care to comment there or speculate?
I don't know what Sparkle is. What's a Sparkle?
That's the you should know that. You're in Seattle. The Microsoft direction.
They're heading towards Sparkle? Did you make that up?
No,
Is that
I.
like spam or something?
Oh, you've heard of Avalon then, right?
Yes, I've definitely heard of Avalon. I haven't actually done a technology evaluation of it, so I should probably, keep my mouth shut. Someone
Okay.
asked me before about, what do you think about Avalon? And my answer was basically, look, I ran out of patience with Microsoft a long time ago. Every 2 years, they announce that they're going to come up with a really great framework. And if we just hold on, if we just wait, then this really great framework is going to be right around the corner. It's going to make everything completely automatic, and it's all going to be amazing. And I'm just like, why would I believe them this time? Why would I suddenly believe that Microsoft suddenly had this cache of really wonderful programmers that they've been hiding all this time, and these guys gained power, and now they're going to push it through that their APIs are going to be the paramount APIs at Microsoft, and they're going to enable all these wonderful programs. I
And
just don't find that likely.
well, then you could write
And
to
I
90%
could
of
be
the
wrong.
market.
What's that?
I said, then you could write something that you could sell to 90% of
Well, I mean, that's the thing is,
the
it's one of these things where it's like, is it really in Microsoft's interest to make small guy developers productive? Because, they make all their money selling Office. That's their cash cow.
There you go.
So if they suddenly make it so that, one guy, two guy shops can really compete, then they're losing money. And, it's a simple like economics thing. If you look at, who stands to gain, who stands to lose? The thing that makes Apple very attractive to me as a company is not that I believe that everyone who works there is a saint. It's just that they stand to gain from my success. Apple as a company really gains by having a very active third-party software community that comes up with these really cool, innovative apps. And they spend a lot of time celebrating us. They have the Apple Vine Awards where they basically say, let's celebrate, the independent guys who write really neat stuff for us. And and there's no equivalent to Microsoft because honestly, there's no reason for them to love independent developers. They are the biggest developer for themselves and they want to be that. And they're not about to just give that up and say, oh, it would be nice as if we were nice to everybody and we just, we helped out the small guy. That'd be nice of us. There's no concept for that. And I don't think Apple's doing it because they're nice either. I'm not like Apple's a good guy. I'm just saying Apple's interests coincide with mine. Apple wants small developers. I want to be a small developer, so I'm going to go to the platform that wants me.
I think that'll sit well with folks. Well, what about Zoka? You actually give attribution on your website about your workplace. How's that worked out for you guys? I mean, how many is it just you that I mean, now that Mike's not there, is it just you working there sometimes, or does Drew join you?
Well, I mean, sometimes, but it used to be sometimes that too. I mean, the nice thing about it is, it's open from 7 a.m. to midnight. We come and go as we please. We don't have to worry about security. We don't have to complain about, hey, someone forgot to lock the building last night. We don't have to worry about janitorial. We don't have to worry about electrical. We don't have to worry about phones. We don't have to worry about the network connection. We don't have to worry about providing service for people. We don't have to worry about cleaning up the dishes. The list just goes on and on and on and on and on. It's just they spent a bunch of money buying antique furniture from the same place where I bought my furniture for my house. And it's all, hardwood. And they spend a lot of time training their baristas who, tend to be more, sort of professional baristas and less, sir, please drink your coffee. And, for the last, I think, 2 years, they've had the regional champion barista has been from the Zoka where, from Zoka. So,
In the non-Starbucks espresso world, huh? Of
yeah. So,
competition.
and it's all the difference in the world. But besides that, it's just a really nice I mean, I'm sure, you know, any cafe will have, you know, a lot of the benefits that I talked about. You know, just any cafe is going to have. Soak is especially nice, and the people are very nice there.
But, so you're able to focus there. You're obviously able to get some work done there, or you wouldn't go.
Yeah, no, Tim Omerick, back when he was working for me, he had a lot of trouble when there's all the noise and everything. But I find it oddly kind of easier to focus when there's a bunch of hustle and bustle around me that doesn't concern me than if I'm just in like a quiet room. And honestly, it's just nice to meet people. I've made, you know, like 20 or so friends, you know, just over the year and a half I've been there. And, you know, at my old workplace, I was in my own little office all day by myself. And it was really just
so
kind
lonely.
Of boring. So lonely.
Well, I think the cube farm does attract, does appeal to somebody, you know, really working in a cube farm with the, what do you call it, a suspended ceiling and fluorescent lighting. That works for some people, but, I tend to like a little bit of noise myself, too.
Yeah.
We have some good comments here, a litany of questions from Justin Van Patten, just asking kind of general entrepreneur questions. I think you'd probably be a great guy to answer. Talking about, if you want to comment quickly on the, you know, the circumstances behind starting both Omni and Delicious. Obviously, that was a pretty wide span of time. You got any thoughts there?
Yeah,
I
mean,
what's your mindset on starting each of them and, you know,
Omni was sort of, you know, accidental, as it were. You know, I was doing consulting for Next as a person, and I, you know, after a while, and I had a couple other contracts too, with like Lighthouse Design, which got bought out by Sun, and their president is now the president of Sun, Jonathan Schwartz. So, and then I brought in, you know, Ken and Tim, and said, you know, hey guys, I've got more work than I can handle. Do you want to come work with me? And they said, sure. And so we all worked together. And, you know, at that time, just database work was just making an unbelievable amount of money. It was just unbelievably valuable. And so we were just, you know, for kids just like totally fresh out of college, we were making just an incredible amount of money. And so, you know, we didn't know what to do with ourselves, basically. And so, you know, we got an office and started working in the office. And then, you know, we said, well, let's, you know, let's incorporate. And why not? It makes it easier to bill people if you have a corporation. So we incorporated. And then, you know, a little bit later, we decided to start working on a product. But it was kind of, you know, accidental. We were just like, well, this will be fun to work on. Let's work on it. And then we said we could sell it. And, you know, so then we started selling OmniWeb, I guess, was one of our very first real for sale products. And that was just accidental that we sold it. I mean, we were giving it away, and then the government called us, and it was an organization who, at the time, didn't even admit they existed. They've since admitted they exist, but I believe it was the NRO who first called us and said, you know, and they were huge Next customers. And and so they called us and said, you know, well, we really like your web browser and we'd like to buy it. And we're like, well, you don't have to because it's free. And they, you know, they literally were like, well, we're the government and we, you know, we have to buy it if we're going to use it. And I'm like, well, you know, but it's free. And they're like, well, you know, that's just not acceptable. And I'm like, fine, you know, how much do you want to give us? And they're like, well, how about, you know, $12,000? And I'm like, to me, that was just an insane amount of money. I just couldn't believe $12,000.
Per
like,
seat.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, nowadays, you know, I'd be like, you know, I would have taken him to town, but back then I couldn't believe it. And so they sent us this check, and I remember parading around the office with this check for $12,000, thinking, you know, it was like the most money we would ever see. And, but you know, that was the beginning when we realized, hey, you know, we can make money doing this. And there's a very valuable lesson in there, I think, in terms of entrepreneurship, and this is, you know, really huge, which is people like paying for software. And just because there's a freeware version of something doesn't mean you shouldn't come out with a commercial version. And in fact, the opposite is true. If there's a freeware version of something, it means there's a market for it. But the people who use free software right now, and this may change in the future, but right now, almost entirely separate from the people who pay for software. And so if you see a freeware version of something and you like it, it behooves you to come out with a commercial version and sell it, because the people who are, you know, going to go to the stores and look on the store shelves and all that are different. And freeware stuff is not taken very seriously right now. I think that's a shame, but it's still the truth.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really see it reviewed that much in magazines, whereas if you stick a label on it and say this is for sale, you know, you get reviewed, you get publicity, you go to trade shows. So that would be, you know, for entrepreneurs, lesson number one. Delicious was actually founded entirely differently, you know, because at that point I'd, you know, been running a company for 11 years and knew a little bit more about companies and what they involved. And so we were much more efficient about it. We knew we were going to be a company, you know, within about 2 weeks of leaving Omni. I'd, you know, already created the company and filed all the paperwork and, you know, figured out the taxes and gotten out the accountant and done everything. And we knew what the products were going to be. You know, we had everything sort of planned out in advance. And but you know, but still, you know, I think the lesson from Delicious for me was, you know, just staying flexible and staying open to ideas. Because initially what we were going to do is we were going to have Delicious be sort of a mentoring house, and we were going to find shareware developers and sort of help them, you know, get their code up to snuff. We were going to, you know, help their interface, help their code. Just, you know, I was going to help them rewrite their code. Mike would help them do their interfaces. Mm-hmm. And then we'd sell their stuff under our label. And that was our initial idea. And then, you know, it just totally flopped. And we just, I mean, flopped, not failed, but flopped as in we just totally flip-flopped. We said, no, you know, here's what we're going to do. We're going to work on this app, and we really love this app, and we think it's got huge potential, and we don't really want to work with these other shareware people because that's kind of a pain. You know, so the company initially was this one thing, and then it very quickly, you know, a month later, we're like, nope, this other thing. And, you know, we just kind of rolled with it. We didn't just say, no, we found it on this. We have to do this. You know,
exactly.
Pound through Iraq war kind of thing. No, it's like, stay flexible, figure out, you know, what you're doing, and then, you know, keep your eyes open at all the time. And then there's other business opportunities out there, and you always, you know, it does pay you to be focused and say, no, this is, you know, this is the best business opportunity, but it also pays you to always reevaluate and say, well, wait a minute, you know, maybe I should pursue this instead.
Well, sounds like some great advice. lots of people, you know, get committed to their original mission, and when they have too many people on board or employees, it's difficult to change the course a lot of times.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you had a great post recently about wine. Are you going to be involved in taking advantage of that opportunity down the road, or are you just trying to incite some other folks to get serious about wine on OS X?
I don't think I'm going to have time to do it, which is maddening, because I think it would be exciting as heck.
Been around
and
forever.
It's one of these things where it really does need good programmers to make it good. You know, it's like if everyone just says, oh, this will never work, then they're right, it won't work. But if everyone says, hey, this is going to be awesome, then it's going to be awesome. You know, we
can
know,
you encapsulate
we know
your post? Can you say something about just encapsulate that the your idea on that blog post about wine and what it is?
Well, I mean, wine has been a project for forever, essentially, and it's a set of it's sort of incorrect to say it's an emulation layer, but the easiest thing to say is it's an emulation layer for Windows. But the cool thing is that it can actually run, it runs the Windows apps as if they're native apps on, you know, inside of another operating system. But what's cool about it is instead of loading, you know, like most things like virtual PC, you actually load a complete copy of Windows into your machine, and then you run the Windows program inside your little virtual Windows running inside your Mac OS. And it's just, it's really ugly and it's really slow. Wine potentially gets around both the ugly and the slow problems because they've just rewritten Windows natively. They've rewritten all the functions that a program can call in Windows. They just rewrote natively, you know, in your operating system. And so, you know, you actually get to take advantage of the speed of your operating system. You're not just emulating everything. And, you know, it potentially could be really, really cool. And obviously right now it's not super optimized, but they do have games working on it. You know, the other thing is that you can, you know, you just can double click on an app, on a Windows app, you know, potentially inside Mac OS X, and it would just launch and run in another window, and you wouldn't necessarily know it was a Windows application. And I think that's just incredibly powerful. And, you know, other people have argued very vociferously that they think the sort of idea of virtual machines is going to be dominant instead, which is like you're going to be running Microsoft Windows and you're going to be running OS X at the same time, sort of, and then you like press a hotkey to switch between them. And that technology is certainly a lot farther along, I'll agree with that, but it's also just ugly. And as we've seen from Apple with the sort of classic versus carbon, no one runs classic anymore. It's just gone. And, you know, and that was the exact analog. It was a virtual machine that ran old code. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But everybody updated to carbon because the experience was just so much better for the user. And so if some people actually, you know, get busy and make it so that Wine runs really well natively inside the standard OS X Finder workspace, it's just going to be incredible. I mean, it'll initially only run on Intel Macs. There's an idea of doing a processor emulation for older Macs, but I'd be surprised if that has decent performance anytime soon. But you have the potential to run apps at completely full speed. And it wouldn't take that many apps to make the project really shine. You know, my argument is basically if you had one game come out and, you know, if Doom 4 came out or whatever and it worked with Wine, it doesn't matter if other games don't. You'd still go ahead and install Wine because you're like, dang, I can play Doom 4 today instead of, you know, waiting 9 months for the port.
No doubt.
So I think once it gets rolling, it's just going to be unstoppable. But
well, hopefully Intel means more things than just new chips for the hardware.
Yeah, I think there's a whole slew of just amazing things just around the corner with it. But
if you were in software management at Apple, where would you take the company in terms of pro apps, iApps, pro hardware, etc.? What do you have anything on your wish list or?
Oh man, I'm just thankful I'm not.
You did write a bit about the rumor mongering recently. What was that? The silly season, I think. Rumor debunking business.
Yeah, well, I mean, somebody had revived the whole Apple's going to come out with Yellow Box for Windows, which is essentially the exact opposite of Wine. You can run Mac OS X apps natively on Windows. And I'm just like, at this point, now that they're coming out with their own Intel machines, that makes absolutely no sense from a financial standpoint, or at least no sense. You know, there's no sensible reason given. Someone may have some reasons, but I don't think it makes any sense. And I think it's someone just trying to pull people's chains. The thing about Apple and when people talk about various scenarios and, they may come out with this and they may come out with this, is one of the things that Apple said or Steve actually said recently in public that I thought was really, really true. You know, he was really not just spouting off of the mouth. Is someone said, well, why don't you integrate like satellite radio into the iPod? And he said, it seems like it'd be kind of cool, but we want to move really carefully because once you put a feature in there, you can't take it out.
Yep.
And that's just so true. And it's everyone's kind of like, well, why doesn't Apple just release Yellow Box? Why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? Mm-hmm. And the answer is because once they do it, they can't undo it. And, they actually did release Yellow Box once. And then they were young enough, and there were so few people at that point using it, because that was back in the dark days, 96, 97, that they actually did undo it. But undoing it cost them a lot. I mean, we were one of the customers for Yellow Box, and we had clients using it, and when Apple undid it, our clients were just kind of like, oh, we're up a creek and there's nothing we can do and we're just screwed and we're going out of business. And it was a very, very bad thing. If they did that today, it would be just an absolute PR nightmare. It would just kill them dead. I mean, it wouldn't just kill them, but it would be very, very bad.
It reminds me of Emilio's decision with power computing, and it cost him quite a bit to get out of macOS licensing too.
Yeah, exactly.
To kill that, they had to kill a business and cost them, $120 million?
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, you look at any company, like HP, where they're like, oh, we're going to sell iPods. And then it was like, whoops, no, we're not. And, how many hundreds of millions were spent on that deal with the promotion and the packaging and the lawyers and the negotiating? Ugh. And then they just like, whoops. And so you really got to be careful about what direction you go in. And when you're that big, you really, really got to be careful because you don't have as many chances to just kind of like screw up and say, and shrug it off and, walk away from it, Like right now, I think some people are upset because Aperture runs slowly on machines that aren't recommended for Aperture. And, I'm like, it's one of these things where, you don't want to, Apple doesn't want to be seen failing because anything that will find a weakness, people just pounce on it. You know, oh my God, if you drop an iPod from an airplane, it could scratch. And this has been like headlines for like 2 months now that it's possible to scratch an iPod. And I'm like, hey guys, here's a funny story. I dropped my cell phone the other day and it scratched.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, my cell phone has scratches. I don't know how.
You carry it with keys and coins. It might get scratched. Maybe Nokia will maybe follow us, put a disclaimer on their phones from here out.
Yeah.
Let's, you commented earlier on the UI design, or just everything about the company. You want to make it everything polished, do it right, you know, whether it's email addresses, design, icons, et cetera. I got a question here from Adam Gerson about, you know, he says he's good at making a program 80% great, but what advice do you have on making it just what he says 100% awesome? You know, where, say an independent developer, where could they focus their time and energy to, you know, put out the best?
I mean, I think the trick is to figure out which features are really compelling and try to make those better and figure out which features, like, you know, are like cool, but maybe you didn't do a good enough job on them for this release, or or maybe, you know, only like 2% of your users are going to use them, or maybe they're good features, but they just don't belong in this program, they belong in a different program, and then just cut them. Don't try to do too much, even if you've got sort of a decent partial solution and you're kind of saying, well, partial's better than none. I think that's a mistake. I think it's better to just say, no, do none. You know, the thing I always point to is in Delicious Library 1, we actually had a feature to output your collection to a website. And, you know, it sort of worked, but it didn't really work very well. And we just said, you know what? When we do this, we want to do it really, really well. We want people to go, oh, my gosh, that's so cool. That's correct. That's the way to do it. We don't want, you know, sort of a decent solution and then do a really good one later, because the problem is everyone's going to remember the decent. You know, you don't really get a second chance to make people go, wow. They they look at it and, you know, I mean, I know people still think iPhoto is slow because they look at iPhoto 1 and they're like, slow. And I'm like, iPhoto is like lightning fast now. But, you know, they're like, no, slow, not interested, slow. And it's one of these things where you don't want to release anything just without a ton of polish. And so make sure you polish the heck out of the stuff you have and then just cut the rest. It's not going to hurt you. You know, you're going to get the same, you know, feature request over and over again. But, you know, that's just like, that's life. It's like, you know, it's okay. If 100% of your users have the exact same feature request, it's actually kind of nice because it means, you know, your life just got a lot simpler because you definitely know what you want to add to 2.0 if everybody's asking the same features. You know?
Well, that's a topic that Jason Fried from 37 Signals has gotten a lot of traction and a huge audience for, talking about, you know, doing a couple of things right and forget about the rest. You know, get your product out there, make sure you do those few things very, very well, and you know, don't try to be Microsoft and, you know, come out of the gate with 1,000 features.
I think the days of the check boxes are over, thankfully. You know, it used to be people just looked at the box and they compared the check boxes on the box and said, this one does this, and this one does table flammables, and this one does slimity flammables. And nowadays, I really think people, they look at the software and they say, wow, this feels great. I'll recommend it. And, you know, it's been a real revolution because, you know, for a long time, it really was just all about get as many checkboxes as you possibly can so that you can get, you know, on the shelves.
Well, maybe that was a symptom of competing on with shrink wrap software, where everyone did compare it on the shelf instead of getting to experience it, you know, with the instant gratification of a download, a demo, trying it, and not necessarily comparing it to the, you know, the 10 other apps out there that might do something similar.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Nowadays, there's almost no app that doesn't have a demo available for it, and so we've all gotten a lot more used to just messing around and seeing how we feel. And that's much more important than, you know, how many features it has in the raw.
Well, I think you've provided a wealth of information to, you know, experienced and new Cocoa developers alike. Really appreciate you coming on the show, and I look forward to hearing great things out of Macworld and whatever else you got in the pipeline.
Well, thanks. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, we'll look for questions on the blog. I think we'll have some follow-up questions there, and we'll be in touch soon.
Okay. Wonderful.
Thanks, Will. Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with Will Shipley. I know it ran a bit long, but I couldn't really find much I wanted to cut out, so I just left it all in there for you. I want to put another thanks out to Slide for sponsoring the show today, and a reminder to you guys to send your information to coco@slide.com if you've got some spare cycles or are looking for a full-time Coco gig. They are located in San Francisco and would be happy to talk with you. Next show is coming up. Please post questions for Colin Barrett and crew over at the blog when they come on the interview to discuss Adium, the multi-protocol IM chat client. Stay tuned for more shows, and you know, why not tell a friend, even a Windows developer, to tune into Coco Radio and hear some of the great passion behind apps on OS X. I know they're probably looking for an answer to .NET and the Windows platform. So spread the word and get in touch with me if you've got any ideas or contributions you'd like to make. Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.